Welcome to the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. This is a place where radical ideas and methods are discussed in the quest towards freedom making. It is a space to dialogue, share, and learn about revolutionary politics, political struggles, radical solidarities, cultural resistance, healing justice, and is a crossing to unearth legacies of resistance pedagogies, global radicalism, and internationalism. I'm your host, Chani Desai, and if you like this episode, please subscribe. Welcome to another episode of the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. In our series on uprisings and pedagogies of rebellion, today I would like to welcome our guest, Eve Saint. Eve Saint is an Indigenous land defender and the daughter of one of the hereditary chiefs of the Wet'suwet'en First Nation, whose sovereign lands in northern British Columbia were raided by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the RCMP. On February 7, 2020, RCMP tactical units invaded Gidimdin, one of the two checkpoints set up by the Wet'suwet'en to stop the Coastal GasLink pipeline from being built on their unceded lands. Eve was one of the land defenders that was arrested at Gidimdin. All charges against her and others arrested have been dropped, and she's here in conversation to reflect on that resistance. Thank you, Eve, for being here with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I want to provide some context to our listeners about the Wet'suwet'en land struggle against the Canadian state and industry projects such as pipelines. In February 2020, as I mentioned earlier, the RCMP raided the unceded Wet'suwet'en territory and attacked land defenders to make way for the Coastal GasLink pipeline project. At the climax of the raid, heavily armed police accompanied by snipers and attack dogs arrested unarmed Indigenous land defenders and Wet'suwet'en matriarchs while they were in the middle of a ceremony honoring missing and murdered Indigenous women. This sparked outrage across the country and led to mass uprisings from the east to west coast. Also, solidarity actions were organized by Indigenous and non-Indigenous people across Canada, particularly in the form of direct actions. For example, blockades of railways, highways, ports, legislative offices, government buildings that were meant to disrupt the colonial state, its governance, and its capitalist economy. So, Eve, can you take us back to that moment and tell us about the mass uprisings that took place pre-COVID, and, you know, just explain to us why those uprisings happened and why they were so significant.
Okay, yes. When I first found out about the eviction of CGL by the hereditary chiefs and matriarchs, I knew, like at the time I was out west, we had gotten word that CGL had been granted the permanent injunction. And so I was with my dad, who's the hereditary chief WAS of Cassia House, Gidimdin clan, and that territory that Gidimdin checkpoint is on. And so the next possible moment, we were out on the territory, and then after I kind of learned that, you know, there's going to be an eviction, and I knew I had to make a split decision to stay, and I knew it was going to be huge. I knew that, you know, that that's what people were waiting for, because, you know, the year before with the raid, the first raid, in January, when I get him done, the 14 who got arrested, including Molly Wickham, you know, there was uproar then too. And then it kind of just I hate to say it, but it fizzled out, or it calmed down. They lost momentum. And so I, you know, being out there and still doing work for, you know, doing solidarity work for Unistoden and Gidimdin throughout the whole year. I heard a lot of people be like, you know what, if something big were to happen, I would support again. And that's what I kept on hearing over and over again by like badass, land defenders and activists. So like I believed it too. And so when I learned of the eviction, I was like, oh, this is going to be amazing, this is going to be great. I left my life and I was like, screw this, And this, and at that time, it was the only thing that I could do. It was very like critical for me to stay and like just leave my life. And so, you know, when it came down to it, being on the land, we had 35 days land back. And then it was such a beautiful, beautiful experience to be out there on the land with all these people who have the same heart and the same goal and working hard towards, you know, land protection and land defense. And so when it came down to it with RCMP buildup in nearby towns, and you know it's coming, you know, like that countdown is on, and that you're going to be faced with this colonial violence and weapons and people, and the RCMP with their history of wanting or the violence towards Indigenous people. It's a scary thing. And actually, you know, there's a lot of power in that, making that stand, because you know, not a lot of people can stand there and have 100 RCMP literally fall on your doorstep. Like, that's what actually happened. We had helicopters, the SWAT teams fly behind us and being dropped behind us. So it literally, they were dropping like pretty much on top overhead. And, you know, like, we just had to keep a stand. We had to keep that in our hearts. We had to override that fear and know that we're doing the right thing. And if we were to die, then so be it. Because that's the way Canada treats Indigenous people. As we see now, it's what's going on here during the pandemic. We have COVID, we have RCMP, like, still killing our people. So, you know, we have to, that's what we have to face. And you know what? So be it. So I think that's what contributed to the uprising, because of direct action. And it was a peaceful stance. It wasn't violent. We didn't have weapons. We did, you know, like, we did what we could with what we had peacefully. And I feel like it was made such an impact on people. Like, people needed that. People needed that action. People needed people to stand up and do it, so that they have the courage and the go-ahead to do the same thing. So then all across Canada, we see all these nations, all these territories, all these people stand up along with our relatives, our allies, who stood along with us. And it was just really powerful. It was so powerful to see. I mean, I would do it all over again, because it just really, to me, like, that's the kind of sacrifice that I had to make. Like, I know, like, we got arrested, and it's not ideal, but I mean, it's a system that is designed to kill Indigenous people. So really, to me, in my heart, that is not a justice system for me. And that's a justice system that is designed to kill me. So of course I'm going to make this stand. And being arrested, it kind of doesn't mean anything, because protecting the land means more to me. That is my justice system. That is like our law, and that's the law that I'm following, and that's the law in my heart that I'm connected to the land, to the ancestors, to everybody, humanity, and the animals and the water. So I think that impact too, because I think people felt that in their heart. And you know, it just spread across like wildfire. And it's like we're all connected, actually. We were all connected through our hearts at that time.
I mean, indeed, yeah, the you know, uprisings were incredibly powerful. And something, you know, really powerful you just said, you know, the words, a system meant to kill you. Can you speak to that system a little bit further? Because settler colonialism has been ongoing for centuries on this land, which, you know, people are kind of just waking up to, you know, on a mass scale in terms of their consciousness of knowing about it. But we know that from its colonial foundations, the Canadian state has worked closely with corporations to extract resources, including oil, that fuels a capitalist economy and imperial competition on the global market without Indigenous consent. And so can you tell us about how Canadian capitalism and industries pipeline projects that are, you know, protected through the colonial court system, such as court injunctions, are really violent for Indigenous people and violate Indigenous sovereignty yet again?
Oh, yeah. Wow. It's very destructive on so many levels. First, we have, you know, this injunction. I actually learned afterwards, like, I saw, like, how the injunction and through my experience with getting arrested and having conditions on me, they didn't want me to go back to the territory. And it's just that these injunctions that are in favor of industry, and they have more authority over Indigenous territories. And this is like, once these injunctions are in place, like that, you know, like that's a lot, that restricts a lot of our movement on these territories. Like, you know, people can't go out. We see now with what's going on right now in Gidimden, even recently, like recently, my father and Gidimden, Cassia House, they built a smokehouse on the territory for the people, the clan members to go and fish and smoke fish and hunt. And they had RCMP and CGL in there armed, like armed with heavy artillery, like guns. And it's a small, like they're in the forest. Who knows what would have happened out there? Like, people are in danger, like literally in danger. And so, like, this is the kind of authority, quote unquote authority, that the industry and RCMP and the Canadian government have over Indigenous lands. And our lands get smaller and smaller as each industry, like each mining extraction project goes through Indigenous territories, our land gets smaller and smaller. And this is where we have like stolen land, and it just, we get put on these small little tiny reserves. And so that's one thing. And not to mention the impact of like environmental, like CGL isn't even doing a proper environmental assessment impact. Like, they actually go out, and even if grizzly bears come into close contact with them, they shoot them. They don't care about grizzly bear dens or nests or caribou migration. Like, it's a lot of wildlife and medicines and water, not to mention the Witzinqua River that you can still drink from. It's so like crystal crisp and clean that you can still drink from, is going to be impacted for sure. Like, you know, these pipelines, they leak, they spill. There's, you know, there is destruction in one way or another. And it's, that has long lasting devastating effects, not to mention the people who go out there to hunt and fish. They're not allowed to go out there and be on the land and enjoy the territory. And that's the thing. The territory enjoys the people being out there picking the medicines and getting food and drinking the water. Like, that's our relationship with the earth. And also the industry workers, you know, the man camps that are proposed to be out there, we have like white heterosexual, like cis men, racist cis men in these small towns, and bringing drugs and alcohol and partying because there's nothing to do out there. And they have a mindset that Native Indigenous people are disposable, are they just don't value Indigenous life at all. And we have like a lot of our people going missing, our Two-Spirit, our trans, non-binary, our Indigenous women and children, and men too, right? It affects the whole Indigenous community. And so, like, we are looking at effects that will have lasting effects for generations, not just this generation. It's going to keep on continually destroy people. And so it is not the best for our people. And like Indigenous land defenders see this, and that's why they fight so hard.
So speaking actually of, you know, land defense, many nations across this land put up blockades, and particularly of the railways, to disrupt the supply chains of the Canadian economy. And I want you to speak to why that was so important, because, you know, I remember in the media looking at some people's reactions at that time, especially racists, right, at their reaction towards, like, and I remember what one of the Conservative Party leaders said, like, put your privilege away and go sit down, if you remember that. And so, you know, why is disrupting the colonial economy so important, and why was disrupting and setting up blockades so necessary as an act of resistance? And so I'm wondering if you could speak to that.
Yeah, for sure. I really feel that because a lot of industry and a lot of these railways and highways, they go through Indigenous territory.
Right.
And so, like, we knew that we had to use whatever tools and resources we have, which is not a lot. And so, like, I know that there was one of our sisters, Kanahu's manual from Tiny House, was like, we can shut down Canada by just shutting down railways, highways, industry, because there's mining and extraction. And so that's our power. And again, we're using it with nothing, with but our bodies and our voice. And we're not armed. We don't do this armed. And so we had to use some extreme measures. I mean, that's the thing, when we get taken advantage of and just taken and beaten, like, we have to try to use whatever we can. And I mean, it's so important to do direct action and to disobey, because we're in a society, we are in like this quote unquote nation of Canada that will not respect our lives. They don't want to change. They're not criminalizing murder, like murderers who kill Indigenous people, or the RCMP that is involved with like police brutality against Black Indigenous people of color. Like, it's just a system that won't want to budge. And if we see now not a beautiful example, but like with Black Lives Matter, like this is that their power that they're exercising, and it had to go to that extreme. And I see that there are some progress of change. Like, it might not be the whole system, but there's making some moves. And because of Shutdown Canada, coming back to the Shutdown Canada after the Wet'suwet'en raids, we had to do that. And we had to, actually, because of that, the ministry, Mark Miller, ministry, Carolyn Bennett, sat down with Hereditary Chief Wass and some of the Hereditary Chiefs. So we weren't able to achieve that if it wasn't for direct action or shutting down or blockading. And I'm sorry, Canada. This is what we have to do. This is our lives. This is our lives. And you know what? If the roles were reversed, maybe you would understand. I know it's hard. They don't want to understand. But anyway. But I feel like direct action, in cases, it needs to happen. It just does.
Yeah. So one thing that is significant in all of this is that Canada, by sending the RCMP and invading Wet'suwet'en territory, not only violated Canadian law, but it also, you know, invaded Wet'suwet'en law. And so can you explain what Wet'suwet'en laws are or what that means? Because there are people across this country that actually don't understand that Indigenous people have their own systems of governance and their own laws. And in fact, I think that it was these uprisings that were a moment of, they provided a kind of understanding around, you know, the different systems of governance. And so can you talk about Wet'suwet'en law, Indigenous law, and governance systems?
Yes, for sure. The Wet'suwet'en law and Wet'suwet'en governance, along with, you know, there are many nations that do have, that does have traditional governance in place. Some were lost, a lot were lost during colonization, but Wet'suwet'en governance is still intact. And it's still practiced till this very day. And so there are chiefs. So this is kind of where people get a little wonky, because there is a system in place that was designed by the Canadian government, and it's to put the natives on reserves and to have a chief and council to, you know, make decisions or to, you know, where to spend the money for the community, etc. And so this is really based on Canadian government, like, policies, and there's red tape, there's laws, quote unquote laws, and quote unquote treaties, along with the with INAC, what we call INAC, the chief and council, the reserve chief and council, and that they have to abide by that. So it's really, this system is really oppressing Indigenous people, keeping them, you know, like on the reserve or dependent on the Canadian, like, government system. So anyway, we have that. And then, so a lot of these INAC chiefs that work for the Canadian government, they're, you know, they want to think what's best for their communities. So, I mean, of course, extraction industry, like, they try to work with them, etc. But with the Wet'suwet'en governance, it's an old governance system, and they have hereditary chiefs. So instead of having the vote of who's going to be chief, like, they have the community where, like, these chiefs are trained at a young age and to learn the land. The hereditary chiefs is focused more on the land and taking care of the land, living off the land, and have the wellness of the people. And so so that's what they base their values around and their duties. And so my father, he got his hereditary chief name back in March 2019, and so, like, his name was passed on, and the way he got into his name was actually he was chosen by a very well-respected matriarch in his clan, in the Grizzly House Passia clan, Gidimdun. And so her voice was really well respected, and her input. And so she had put in my father's name for the hereditary chief Was. And so other people has had that name before it gets passed on from person to person. And so and actually, they, the hereditary chiefs of Gitsen and Wet'suwet'en actually had a court case with the Supreme Court of Canada, or no, BC, about the rights and title of the hereditary chief system. And the hereditary chiefs won. And that case was to recognize that the hereditary chiefs did not give up their lands. it was like it's unsurrendered, unseated, and that the governance still is in the hands of the hereditary chiefs, and that they have say, final say of what goes over the territories. Mm. And so even this is where we say that Canada broke its own law, mm. Because they're going against the hereditary chief system and not honoring that. And I think that's where a lot of people got confused about, like, because the INAC chiefs, a lot of them along that pipeline route has signed on or is for the Coastal GasLink project.
Mm. And so for listeners who want to know more about this, they should check out, you should check out the Delgamuukw, the Delgamuukw case, because it'll provide a lot of insight on, what, was preserved and won in that case. But moving to sort of the contemporary, in thinking about the pipeline at the moment, has construction or has plans to have workers been halted, or are they still there? Like, what's happening on the ground? If you can give us a bit of a picture of the contemporary moment.
Yeah. Okay. So, what happened when the ministers Mac Miller and Carolyn Bennett met with my dad and some of the hereditary chiefs? They were supposed to, Coastal GasLink was supposed to halt, stop work on the pipeline, and the RCMP was supposed to move off the territory of Wet'suwet'en territory, and so they temporarily did. And then they only came to an agreement of understanding. Mm. And so at that time, the hereditary chiefs was supposed to go back and see if the people, the clan members, agree with what was discussed in this meeting. And this is another part of their hereditary governance, is that you have a feast with the clan people, and the people decide. Mm. The people decide if it's a good idea or not, and they have a feast, a potlatch, and people come together and discuss and have their input. And so that didn't happen because COVID started started coming into the country, and numbers started rising, and then all of a sudden it was a pandemic. Mm. And so like the hereditary chiefs didn't get to have the meetings. And so Coastal GasLink workers resumed work, and still the RCMP like still continued to beyond the territory to patrol and police the territory. The like camps, people at camps are still getting harassed by the RCMP. And so they are still going through, and but it's still not over. There are people at the camps actively making sure that, you know, the camps are being protected, and the people out there, because the people still want to be out there. Mm. The people still want to like learn how to fish or how to hunt. They trap out there. Mm. They get their food. They go medicine picking. My little sister's out there now after like the whole stand with the RCMP, like that. She's out there. She's out there more than I have, actually. So, and that's good. People see from the movement, also people are healing. Mm-hmm. People are going back to the land, and this is what we need as a people. And so people are still heading out, and I know that they're trying to find any way to fight the pipeline. And just recently, as I mentioned earlier, that the RCMP went there armed to to let themselves in the smokehouse, like, that's trespassing. It's like, you need a warrant to go into these structures. It's not your home. That is people live there. You just don't go in with guns without a warrant. Like, it's not following their law, right? So they're still acting like they're lawless. They're still acting like they're still intimidating the people, the Wet'suwet'en people, the native people, the guests and supporters. And so there's still that going on. It's very policed there, RCMP. Even when I was out there, we had RCMP knocking on my dad's door just to, you know, for a random person. It's like, yeah, right, you're coming to check up on us. We leave town, we have 3 RCMP following us. It's we get pulled over, like, as soon as we're spotted, we get pulled over. And so it is still very heavily a police state.
I mean, this is why we struggle, right? Against the colonial violence of this state, which is deeply linked and connected to the violence of other states, right? And yeah. So I want to move actually to something that is more life-affirming. Because as you were just talking about your sister being out on the land, being able to hunt, being able to fish, being able to trap, you know, reminded me of this essay written by Leanne Simpson, in which she talks about this idea of land as pedagogy. And what I think she means by that is she's talking about land as a form of curriculum, land as a way of knowing in which Indigenous people can connect or reconnect, if possible, to a land base. And learn about Indigenous history, and learn about Indigenous language and culture. And as that process is happening of connection, of being on the land, of engaging in activities that are about mutual survival, land becomes pedagogy. Is what she says. And so I'm wondering if you can elaborate why it might be important for Indigenous people, particularly now as you're on your way to becoming a mother, why you think it might be important for you to have learned from the land, and also how, you know, this might be necessary for future generations.
For sure. I think I really truly believe that Mother Earth is a living being. I believe in creator. I believe in, like, life all around, and you know, to respect and be one with everything and everyone. And when you're out on the territory, when you're out on the land, you just instantly have this connection and relationship, whether it's looking at the water and admiring the beauty, or like hearing the sound of the water and you're like, ah, I just love that sound. Or if you see the sky and the clouds or the stars, and you know, like, that's your relationship with land and the earth and your ancestors, because those are your ancestors too as well. And so when you go out there, you feel good. And you know, that's healing a part of yourself that was lost, because through colonization, we lost that. Like, we were removed, you know, hunting and our ceremonies and our traditional ways was taken from us, our language, our children. And so all these broken pieces of ourselves that was taken, it's like when you're out there and you hear the language, you eat the fish, you walk on the earth, like, you're getting some of those pieces back. And it's helping you become whole. Like, I'm not saying you weren't whole before, but you know, there's some things you might think like, oh, you feel like you're missing something in life. You don't feel fulfilled or at peace or at whole. And it's because there are those pieces shattered out there. When you remove Indigenous people off the land, you take a big piece of home away from them. Like, and I noticed this being an urban Indigenous person growing up in the city. I've never belonged anywhere. And I never felt like that. And I felt even like this is where we see a lot of homelessness in Indigenous communities and people on the streets, because they were taken from their homes. They're not allowed to go back, or because of the status or the INAC or that Indian Affairs whole that whole system, you lose your right to go home, or you lose your right your lands and hunting and fishing. And so because I'm an Indigenous person, like, I won't be able to go live on my mom's reserve at Attawapiskat, or like I don't have that. And you know, a lot of people feel that, and so it's very important to learn those pieces of yourself. I know also our ways, our spiritual ways, have, you know, been demonized or been taken from us. And, you know, a lot of people don't feel that, but I mean, even just to be out on the land or fish or hunt, that's something. that's an ancestral, like, power there that we share. So I mean, whatever your belief is, because I know everybody has different beliefs, and I mean, it's just a way of life, I believe. So
and I imagine that you're going to be teaching your child these connections to the land, I'm guessing.
Also. For sure. So right now we're back in Ontario, and even she has a real strong connection to her my father's territory, because we were out there and she was there, and she's just been with me. Like, every time I go there, like, I have this strong connection, and so I'm carrying her, and so she has this strong connection too as well when we step out on that territory. And we're here back in Ontario, Six Nations, where again there's like this beautiful greenery around us, and you know, so she has this connection with her father's territory. And you know, even right now as we speak, this energy, these words are going into her. She's hearing this right now. And so she's like, oh, yeah, there goes mom again. But she's definitely going to be in these footsteps until she makes her choice if she wants to or not, whatever her life path takes her. But I know this is where kind of my life path is kind of taking me.
And I mean, the other thing is, you're an educator, right? Like, even if you're not formally a teacher, during especially the Shutdown Canada movement, and the moment where reconciliation was called dead, you were doing a lot of public education by speaking at meetings, at teach-ins, at rallies, at gatherings. And I'm just curious about what were some of the main key kind of teachings or ideas that you wanted to give to people who showed up in solidarity? What were some of the ways that you thought, or what did you think was important for them to know as you did, you know, your public education to raise people's consciousness?
Yeah, I really feel like strongly about empowering people to use their power, to use their voice, and that we need everyone's voice and presence, and that, like, even though they may not think that they're making a difference, they are, by showing up, by doing their work. But because this is hard work, it's not easy. And, you know, a lot of people get defeated just because they're like, oh, there's no change, or there's no point. But right, like, we need this, we need the change, we need these drastic actions, because like, if it just stays the same, if nobody does anything, then it just it stays the same. And so I like to encourage people to, you know, use their gifts. We all have beautiful, special, unique gifts that we all contribute and that we can all use. And whether it be art, singing, building, or talking, or traveling, or being at the front lines and cooking, or learning, even learning is a gift. Learn your language, learn how to hunt, learn how to chop up kindling or use a wood stove. Like, you know, we have to start somewhere. I started somewhere. And you know what? You go as a student. I'm still a student. I'm like, I'm here to learn. And I'm here because I want to be. And, you know, like, nobody should be being like, oh my God, like, you don't know nothing. Like, that's, I've never experienced that before with anyone, where I'm like, I don't know anything, because I don't. And so it's, you know, I find that people are very encouraging and they want you out there and they're happy that you've come out. And I think we just need everyone on board, all our allies and relatives, and use their special gifts. Sometimes, you know, they can get in places where other people can't, maybe because of our, you know, skin color, right? Like, yeah. So we need those allies, to those lawyers, to like sue the police, or, you know, sue the government, because, you know, we need people in the, who have the resources and the power to do that. And I also like to really encourage people that, yes, it's just the outrage. You know, sometimes I like to say, I like to rage out, and it's a way for me to channel my anger and my rage. And that's where you can, you can go out there and yell and, you know, be angry, as long as you're doing it in a constructive way and where it doesn't harm anybody else. You know, channel that, because a lot of people are, right? Like, this ain't easy work. And, you know, we've been oppressed and killed and, you know, treated really bad. Of course, we're angry.
Yes, about using anger in ways that fuel justice and fuel, you know, the move towards liberation, and fuel visions for working towards another world. So yes, I am so with you for that. And, you know, thank you for sharing those insights. So Eve, I want to move us actually to the present, because recently, I heard, that there was a hearing, for the land defenders, that were arrested during the RCMP invasion, of the Wet'suwet'en Nation, in the courts. And I was just wondering if you can tell us about, what the outcome of those hearings were, and yeah, if you can just give us a little bit of an update on where things might be around that.
Oh yeah. So when we got arrested, there's 22 of us that got arrested. There was initially 28, but 28 got their charges dropped because they weren't in the way of the roadblock. They weren't in the way of workers accessing the road to the pipeline. So that was the raid of 39, Camp 39. And that was they went in there with violence, guns drawn, canine dogs let off the leash, smashing windows to get to, land defenders. And so those six got their charges dropped. So that was very unnecessary for the RCMP to go in like that onto a peaceful camp that was just there peacefully. As for us, the other 22, Gidimden and Unistoden and Camp 27, we got our charges dropped. Mm. And which was it's great. It's a great relief because you know, we are being criminalized, and you know, one wrong move and the RCMP have the power to be like arrest them. Mm. And like I can't chance that in my condition. I'm with child, and it's just anyway. So it was such a huge relief to have the charges dropped, but also you get an outrage because it's like you had 100 RCMP come in fully armed, TAC teams, helicopters, like it looked like Black Ops that was taking these TAC teams and dropping them like behind us and all that for 4 unarmed Indigenous people. Like it's like, wow, how much like money did that cost, or like all that time and everything and all that violence? Like even though they might have not, you know, shot at us or anything like that, but still that violence and that potential for violence, even having snipers aiming their gun at us and like all that, just treating us like we're criminals. And I mean, that was unnecessary.
For sure.
That was totally unnecessary. And we went through all that just to have the charges dropped. And so that is what, you know, us Indigenous land defenders go through. And yeah, and then all of a sudden you're surveilled. I'm pretty sure that I'm still surveilled. Mm-hmm. At this, you know, we step out on a scene, like back when I was out in northern British Columbia, there on my dad's territory, or like in Wet'suwet'en territory. As soon as we step on like a peaceful protest, RCMP is like pointing at us, whispering, drones are up, like to take pictures of us or whatever. Yeah, so it's just like, it's just really, it's like enraging because like you have no faith in like the RCMP, you have no faith in the government. Like I haven't really before, but now it's diminished. Mm-hmm. It's diminished. I do not trust at all.
Well, I think this is also, you know, in the resistance towards colonial violence, the calls for defunding the police, the demilitarization of the police and RCMP and the, you know, and abolition are so important, right? Because these strategies of resistance and organizing are also about shifting the way we think about colonialism and dismantling the very apparatuses that keep colonialism in place, right? So the protection of property, the use of police forces to acquire property, to engage in conquest, to, you know, and so I think it's a reminder that as police forces are used for the dispossession of Indigenous people and are used to grab land and take land and property and transform that into property, that the defunding, demilitarization, and abolition of the police is very much not just something that needs to happen in the US, but also needs to happen here, right? And I think that that the movement for doing that right now is exciting, even though we know the state will always find ways to co-opt, you know, really radical ideas around defunding, demilitarization, and abolition. So that's something I've been thinking about a lot is, you know, what is the work that us activists have to do to be able to, you know, make these connections and to put that as part of our strategy too, in resisting, you know, colonial violence. So I just want to end with my final question around, what does liberation mean to you?
Oh, wow. Yeah. What does liberation mean to me? Oh my God. When I first learned about residential school and oppression of Indigenous people, that's where I found my voice, and I was so outraged and hurt, and I just wanted to scream at the top of my lungs, but I did. Like I that's where I started my activism, and in my early 20s, and that's what you picture this whole time, where your people can be free of pain and hurt and like just getting the shitty end of the stick all the time, or being treated that way. Like, you know, we just want to be human beings. We want to, you know, be able to get ahead, right? Like, we want to be, you know, like we were here before Canada. We were here and like living in societies and civilizations and living a beautiful life. And, you know, now we have a lot of broken communities and people, and there needs to be a lot of healing. And we just keep on getting, like, we just keep on getting hit with colonization, with killings, with RCMP, with industry. Like, it's a continuation. When people tell us to get over it, that's in the past. No, it's not. No, it's not. It's continuing till this very day. It's continuing. It wasn't that long ago. Like, my grandmother went to residential school. My father went to residential school. That's there, you know, like my father's still in my life, and, you know, like, these things are not in the past. They are still happening. And so, like, liberation, I think you keep on going. And, you know, like, my big thing about me too is, like, you know what? You never know who's watching your actions. You never know who you're inspiring. And even try to talk when you're the only person who can talk. Even if your voice shakes, do it, because somebody is listening. Even if it's your little child listening, and because they are listening, they're listening to everything. And so we need to inspire those people to have, like, the knowledge of history, the history of colonization, and listen to the elders or the teachings or our ways, so that they can get the healing back. And we need to be brave in our actions to go out onto the land and to break free from cycles of destruction, may it be alcoholism, may it be, like, even depression. Like, everybody has depression, but we got to, like, take care of ourselves. We got to be brave. We got to do what's best for ourselves. We got to love ourselves again. And so liberation means all those things to me, is to really love yourself and take care of yourself and to be well and happy in whatever. That doesn't have to mean you have to go out there and march and, you know, like, go to actions. It just means be happy, love yourself, love your family, like, heal those wounds. And, you know, I know we won't see that. I don't know. It's going to take some generations, but the more people start, the more we heal our people, the more we heal our future generations. And, I think, you know, every action we do now will have effects in the future. So that's what liberation means.
Well, Eve, thank you so much for your time, for being with me in conversation today, but also the really powerful, fierce work you do to protect, your territories. And I know how much you have sacrificed and how much is at stake for you all the time. And I just want to honor the powerful work that you do and just say thank you.
Ah, thank you, Chimi Gwech. Yes, thank you for your work that you do too as well. And yeah, I'm happy that we're in contact, and Yeah, I'm happy to. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. If you'd like to learn more and engage with us, please check us out at www.liberationpedagogyproject.com and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.